And welcome to Pitch and Play, a podcast about actually playing the games that your friends recommend. My name is Cassie.
And my name is Ross.
And last week, or 2 weeks ago, we do this every 2 weeks. Last fortnight, Ross pitched. We definitely don't sit down and record a bunch of these at the same time. last time, Ross pitched Rise of the Tomb Raider to me. So we are going to get into our like in-depth, spoilerly discussion of Rise of the Tomb Raider. And Ross, can you give us a recap of why you thought I should play Rise of the Tomb Raider?
Yeah, cool. So Rise of the Tomb Raider is an action-adventure game where you play as Lara Croft going on a merry raiding of tombs. It's mostly shooter, action, exploration, narrative-focused, and it's is recommended because I think it is the best out of this trilogy, the most recent trilogy called the Survivor Trilogy. I think it has a lot of good intentions, a lot of good improvements. And you said you played the first game in this trilogy, but never this one, really?
Yes.
So that made me go, perfect. This is a good opportunity because I think you'll enjoy it. And that's cool. What we really want from this podcast, right? Us to enjoy the games.
That ideally, but it feels like it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Well, I'm happy to say that I did like this game. So
yay,
we get to have positive conversations. So to recap a little bit of what I said in the pitch too, I did play the first Tomb Raider reboot in, I think, 2015. I really liked it. I had never played a Tomb Raider game before, but it was just kind of like I had my PS4 and Tomb Raider felt like a new game to me. And I was like, I'm going to play a new game, like a modern game, rather than like replaying Jack and Daxter for the 100th time. So I liked that first Tomb Raider a whole lot. And I had started Rise of the Tomb Raider a few years ago and played like 20 minutes of it. And yeah, I was really excited for Rise of the Tomb Raider when it was first announced because I had played that first one. And I feel like the marketing and the trailers led me to believe that Rise of the Tomb Raider was going to focus on Lara recovering from like PTSD from the first game.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that really happened. I was hoping like, because the first game, as fun as it was like a Disney ride. You were just going from like set piece to set piece. And the story was enough to keep you interested, but it was not like meaningful storytelling in a way. So my hope was with Rise of the Tomb Raider, I was like, oh, they're really going to dig into Lara's character and like really make the character grow and develop her and like have sort of a more character focused narrative than the first game. Because the first game did focus on her character, but it was like, this is how Lara got strong and learned how to use guns, which isn't super interesting to me.
I mean, this is the trilogy where she actually learned to use the bow before using the guns.
Okay, sure. All right. So yeah, I thought that this game would maybe respond to that first game as like an extended trauma survival event and comment on that. I don't think it really does. But I will say that the storytelling in this game does feel a lot more ambitious. So I did try to write a story summary for this game. And then I realized there's a hell of a lot of like back and forth in this game. So I know that this is not a perfect story summary, but I'm going to try at least on some level to hit the big beats. So this game takes place primarily in Siberia. There's a really brief portion early on where you're in Syria, but otherwise the game is primarily in Siberia. The backdrop of the game is very much like the remnants of the Soviet Union and all of the like artifacts and stuff are either like Cold War Soviet era stuff or like Byzantine Empire stuff. Lara goes to Siberia with Jonah, who is the only returning character from the first game, which devastated me because I don't know how well you remember the first game, but one of the major characters in Lara's crew was Sam. Sam was the one who was like kidnapped by Matthias and was like they were trying to turn her into the Sun Queen or some shit. And it was Lara having to save her.
Yeah.
There were some real lesbian vibes going on in that first game that I very much, very much bought into. So I was very sad to see Lara's girlfriend did not make a return in this game. I will hold out hope for Shadow of the Tomb Raider.
I've played that game and I don't know if I want to spoil it.
Shit. All right. That means she's not in there.
Yeah, I mean, you've got more, I guess, explaining potentially to do on the story, but just to mention of what you've done at the what you've said at the moment. One, that is, it was bad in a way, because there didn't feel like such a continuation of that story. But I feel like as soon as you're in it in Rise of the Tomb Raider, I'm just gonna call it Rise sometimes.
Okay.
Is it primarily doesn't care necessarily about that. It's trying to tell its own story.
Yeah.
Which I sort of respect.
It's fine.
Yeah. And the second thing is you mentioning, like, you know, in Siberia with Byzantine sort of ruins and also Soviet Union ruins and stuff. The thing that I really liked about this game, and I believe the previous one, was there was an attempt to give that sense of these places that Laura's exploring is a continuation of, like, a larger story. Like, it's not that the Byzantine Empire then went into the Soviet Unions. It was the Byzantine Empire went here, things happened, then they weren't there anymore, and then another group of people stumbled there. And it does give the sense of a history, which I really like.
Yeah, and that's developed because you pick up these artifacts along the way. You pick up, like, audio logs or scrolls along the way that sort of flesh out the setting. And that's something that I think the game does really, really well, and I really enjoyed that. And this game also added a mechanic of language to it, where as you pick up these artifacts, you learn it's Mongolian, Greek, and Russian are the three languages that you're, like, finding the remnants of. And occasionally there will be, like, a monolith where if your Greek knowledge is not high enough, you can't read the monolith, which would point you to, like, a nearby tomb or something. So I thought that that was a cool mechanic that, again, like, served to flesh out the setting and made Lara feel like more of an archaeologist rather than somebody that's just, like, picking up shit on the ground.
Yeah,
so I liked
that. It's pointing that direction. What could it mean? Only a Tomb Raider would know.
So this game takes place primarily in Siberia. Lara is there in pursuit of the divine source. That is what she's looking for in this game. She is looking for the divine source because that is what her father was looking for before he died. And we are led to believe that he committed suicide after becoming, like, the mockery of the archaeology community for saying, like, no, there's this thing out there called the divine source, which grants you immortality. And there we go. We checked that box. We mentioned immortality. And now we don't have to talk about it ever again in this episode.
Oh, you've been waiting for that one.
I have. Like, I turned this game on. I'm like, shit, it really is about immortality. We can't get away from it.
Yeah.
So, like, this is all fine as a story setup. Like, Lara is trying to find the divine source to sort of redeem her father's reputation in the archaeology community. And it's implied kind of makes sense of his death. Like, kind of giving his death purpose of, like, he didn't die for nothing. Closure. I continued his research and found this thing.
Yeah.
The thing is, I don't remember them talking at all about Lara's father dying in that first game. And I believe, like, his death did predate that first game in this universe. I don't know about the other Tomb Raider shit. I feel like he's alive in the Lara Croft's Tomb Raider movies because John Voight plays him.
Funnily enough, because I can't remember the first one of this Survivor trilogy, what I do remember of the Tomb Raider film that was based on that one, he's dead or at least disappeared or something, and Lara finds...
I'm pretty
finds-
sure he was dead.
Yes, like, he inherits it, so...
Okay.
Lara inherits his things, which is then why the kickoff of the first game happens, I believe.
Right. It felt like she was only traumatized by her father's death for the second game, because they were like, we need this for storytelling reasons. And the first game, it was kind of like, she could maybe give a shit about her father dying. I don't remember if that's 100% true, though. It's been a long time since I played that first game.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk too much about the first game when it comes to the story, because I wasn't the biggest enjoyer of it, and so
this game opens up. Lara and Jonah are like traversing these like icy cliffs and everything, and like the start of this game feels like an E3 demo because it really and like that's true of like a lot of the set pieces in this game, and we'll get into that. But so Lara and Jonah are separated eventually. That like Lara falls off a cliff or some shit and is separated from Jonah. And Lara learns that Trinity is also in the area looking for the divine source. And Trinity, I can't remember if they were in the first game or not, but they're basically like a paramilitary organization that is also seeking the divine source. And they are led by this guy named Constantine. Constantine is voiced by Clancy Brown. And I really, like, I have to ask, does Clancy Brown ever get to voice like a good guy?
In any media I've seen, the only one that I can think of, I believe, is like Sleepy Hollow, the TV series. But he dies pretty quick in that.
Okay.
Spoilers. Okay. But it's the only time that I remember him being a good guy. Because, yeah, Clancy Brown does get...
Yeah.
He's got the imposing, like, charismatic, fills the room voice.
It's a great villain voice.
Yeah.
Like, the first time I feel like I noticed Clancy Brown's voice was he played Baron Praxis in Jack 2, and so like that's always what I think of. Clancy Brown, Constantine, interchangeable. Constantine is voiced by Clancy Brown. Constantine is a really interesting villain. I really want to talk about Constantine. I feel like I gotta give a little more story though. So before Lara's father died, he had a girlfriend named Anna, and Anna and Lara seemed to have a good relationship at the start of the game. Eventually, you find out that Anna is also a part of Trinity and that she is Constantine's sister. Constantine is seeking the divine source because Anna is dying from some unnamed illness and he wants the divine source to heal her, basically. And so they've kind of like teamed up with Trinity to do that, to reach that end. And there's like some anxiety between them of like, hey, when we find this thing, Trinity might not let us use it. Like, Trinity's going to take this for themselves, but Constantine is kind of like, I don't give a shit. I'm going to save you, sister. How do you feel about Constantine?
I mean, he has more depth than most of the boring villains of most films, I would say. Just the idea of he's willing to betray his, like, superiors for a family member. You don't usually get that sense of empathy for a villain in a lot of games, but... I mean, I'm not going to say he's complex
no.
as a character.
There's some weird shit going on with Constantine. So first of all, Constantine and Anna have some real like sexual tension for siblings.
I don't remember this.
Until Constantine like directly called Anna sister, I was like, oh, there's something going on here. And then I was like, wait, they're siblings? So whatever. Moving past that. At one point in the game, it is revealed that Constantine has stigmata. You know what stigmata is, right?
Not in a human being.
Okay, stigmata, for some reason I've had to explain what stigmata is like a lot recently. Stigmata is when someone has like holes in the palm of their hand and it is meant to mirror Christ being nailed on the cross. And it's used as like an image in a lot of literary works. At one point in this game, you just like see that Constantine has the stigmata on his hands and then they fucking blow past it and never, ever talk about it until you find an audio log, which could totally be missed by the player. Like, you don't have to pick these things up. You don't have to listen to them. And some of them are like hidden. You find an audio log that Anna recorded, which like this game totally plays into that stupid video game bullshit of like everybody records their inner thoughts on a cassette player that they just leave laying around for everyone. Like, some of them are scrolls written by like ancient civilizations and shit, but sometimes it's just, here's this cassette player where Constantine like recorded his entire plan. Anyway, there's an audio log where Anna explains that as children, she gave Constantine the stigmata when he was sleeping. And he woke up and noticed it and was like, I have been chosen by God. I have so many questions about this that the game is just not interested in answering in the slightest. This is the weirdest fucking thing to just put in your game. This character has stigmata. And like, how does Anna cut his hands in his sleep? How does that not wake him up? How, like, does she just do this continuously throughout his life? Because, like, when you see them in the game, he's bleeding. Like, these are, like, fresh wounds. It's wild. It is absolutely wild.
So, to go back a little bit, just to give a little context, I believe, anyway, is, yes, both Constantine and Anna are part of the Trinity organization,
yeah.
Which, if I remember right, is... It's very Assassin's Creed-y in a way of there's this ancient order which has continued to the modern day, and it's about controlling ancient artifacts, which I believe the Trinity stuff is rooted in like a Christian zealotry, like a Templar-esque type foundation, which I believe they were going more for that religious tinge in this story compared to like the first. So they are compelled by religious ideas. And I think as part of that, a lot of the motivation is also because they're villains, they are motivated by zealotry and overdone like actions because they are the chosen of God or whatever.
Yeah.
And I believe, if I remember right, Anna sort of is implied to be very much a manipulator. Yes. So
Anna gave him those to like kind of like strengthen his faith and like make him believe like this is my mission in life to be a part of Trinity and seek these things out. It's just fucking insane.
I mean, sure, it is stupid as hell, but I guess it sort of speaks to her character because she's Richard Croft, Lara's dad's partner before his death, or lover, or whatever you want to call him. Mm-hmm. And I guess the implication, I can't remember if it was ever confirmed in the game, of she was only doing that to get access to knowledge. So,
no, that's explicit in the game. She was there to get knowledge that she would pass along to Trinity. There is some suggestion that like she is at one point ordered to kill Lara's father and says like she couldn't do it. So there's some implication that like she may have like developed genuine feelings for Lara's father, and like to an extent feelings toward Lara. Like she does seem to care about Lara on some level, but obviously she's still like teamed up with Trinity, so it's not really important.
Yeah. And obviously she's allied and then betrays Lara at one point. So to get more information. So I think there's that sense of, you know, she's supposed to be a manipulator. So weird things just happen to make that happen. But at the same time, it does give her sort of, I would say this largely about the characters in this game. They are tropes of some sort, like very heavily, but then they twist them slightly at least. You know, there's obviously Anna, the manipulator, who gets her way because she's not physically strong, but she's socially strong. Mm-hmm. But she does actually like care about Lara, care about Richard, and care about her brother in some way. And, you know, that gives a bit more depth. Not a load, but enough for this story to seem a little bit more interesting than if she was just evil and, like, cackling and stuff. So
And, like, the first game, Father Matthias, he was a very, like, comic booky villain of just, like, here's this crazy-ass motherfucker who's coming after Lara and her friends. Whereas, like, Constantine and Anna do at least feel like human characters and do have some level of depth to them. But just, like, that scene where you see the stigmata on Constantine's hands and then like it just immediately cuts away and moves on with no explanation. And it was hours later that I found that audio log and I was still like, why the fuck does this guy have stigmata on his hands? But yeah, it was just such a weird like, I don't mind the storytelling bit. It's just a matter of like how it was presented was, I don't know.
Whatever. To not get too stuck on stigmata talk, because it's largely a small part, but I get you've got
it wasn't a grasp for me. Under that.
No, so that's anyway, what I mean.
Yeah, at one point after Lara and Jonah are separated, Lara is captured by Trinity and she meets this guy, Jacob. And Jacob helps her escape a prison. Jacob is a pretty major character in this game. So Jacob is the leader of these people called the Remnant, which is a group of people who are like native to the area, and they are the descendants of the divine prophet, who is the one who like possesses the divine source. This divine prophet, you're led to believe, has disappeared at some point in history, but the Remnant are like the people who are trying to like carry on that legacy, and they're trying to fight off Trinity so that they can keep the divine source out of their hands because Trinity is evil. Jacob has this kind of like weird relationship with Lara at first where like she does help him escape and he helps her escape. So they have this immediate trust, but Jacob is aware that Lara is looking for the divine source. So he's almost like challenging Lara's character throughout the narrative. He's trying to see like, do I help this woman on her quest to find the divine source? What are her goals? What will she do with it? Is she worthy of it? And so they have this relationship that kind of develops over the course of the narrative. And he eventually does decide to help Lara, if only because Lara can help them stop Trinity from getting the Divine Source.
Yeah, there's a bit of a story trope of, you know, are you worthy-esque about this?
Yeah.
So he's judging her character because she already knows, he already knows that, like, Trinity is bad news. No matter who in that gets it, it's going to be bad. Right. Whilst she may be different, but she needs to prove herself to him, even though she doesn't necessarily know that, I suppose. Not, like, explicitly, but yeah.
Yeah. So Lara eventually kind of gains Jacob's trust. He brings her to his people, the Remnant, and she like kind of becomes a part of their resistance force.
Mm.
Jonah at one point is reunited with Lara because he has also been like not caught by the Remnant, but like kind of working with the Remnant. And then he's kidnapped. He gets injured. And Lara takes Jonah to Jacob, and Jacob is able to heal Jonah's wound, which is about to kill him. Jacob heals Jonah using like divine source magic, you're led to believe. And the revelation becomes Jacob is the deathless prophet, the mm-hmm. divine prophet, whatever you want to call it. Was this meant to be like a twist? Did you see that coming? Do you remember at all?
I do remember, and I didn't see it coming.
Okay.
At the time. I don't remember why I didn't see it coming. I think largely because a little background. Tomb Raider games, like the Uncharted games, like a lot of this, dating back to Indiana Jones stuff, really, and probably before that, imperialistic taking over native lands and discovering things and going, ooh, scary. There is a lot of fantasy and mysticism mm-hmm. in these series. So, I don't know, you're looking for the lost city of Atlantis or whatever, and it turns out, I don't know, there's a whole community down mm-hmm. there, and they're all like protected by a giant energy crystal, or there's this ancient Pandora's box or whatever, and it could be a deadly disease that kills everyone. All of these things which are like, oh, it's just a fairy tale, it's a myth. And then when, like, a main character stumbles onto said civilization, they find immortal people
yeah.
and magic and all of this crazy stuff hidden in this part of the world. So I had actually been fairly grounded. Like, I should have known that there'd be some magical thing. And I thought, oh, okay, he heals. Fine. That's the extent of that. But I wasn't expecting it, I guess, largely because the game, apart from over-the-top action sequences and moments of,
yeah,
like,
which we'll
Lara should be dead by now.
Yes.
I think I'd been fairly grounded by the characters. They weren't the stereotypes of, like, Jacob, for example, even though he is the deathless prophet, he's not mystical and wise. He feels very modernly written. Mm-hmm. You know,
he presents himself as, like, a regular guy, kind of, in part to, he's not going to come out and be like, well, I'm the divine prophet, so that would obviously be a very stupid thing to do. But yeah, he does present himself very much as just, like, a regular guy, a regular resistance fighter.
Protecting his people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. He seems like the trope of the leader of the resistance who's trying to take care of his people. And because he has enough of that modern sensibility and talk, he's not like man out of time
mm-hmm.
trope. He just seems regular. Yeah, I just didn't expect it at the time.
Okay.
I'm guessing you did.
Well, so my experience with the first game was kind of like what you said. And part of this is just because I had no contact with Tomb Raider or anything before I had played it. But mm-hmm. in that first game, that slow realization of like, oh, there is actually something supernatural going on here was like an enjoyable twist for me, because that game is very grounded in its storytelling early on. And it's this like, oh, wait, shit, there's something else happening on this island. So I really enjoyed that in the first game. Going into this game, of course, when Lara was like, I'm looking for the divine source, which is the secret to immortality, I'm like, yeah, okay. Like, stranger things have happened. So all right. So I did know that there was going to be like a supernatural thing happening already. And then with Jacob has a daughter in this game named Sophia, who you have also a relationship with. Sophia most of the time calls Jacob father. At one point she says to Lara, like, go speak to Jacob. And when she said that, I was like, oh, so she was calling him father like you call a priest your father. And then I was like, Jacob is a priest, Jacob is the divine prophet. And then it kind of clicked for me. Sophia is Jacob's actual daughter, I came to find out, but yes. That is what like led to me putting that together. So that wasn't like a meaningful twist for me at all. It is meant to be like a big moment in the game of Lara figuring that out, but that was a little spoiled for me, I guess. But anyway, eventually Lara, with the help of Jacob, finds the Atlas, which is a map that is pointing her to the center of the ancient city of Katesh, which houses the divine source. Lara fights her way down there and fights her way through deathless guardians. Yeah, which is interesting, and we can certainly talk about. She kills a bunch of them. She recovers the divine source, but Anna is there and takes the divine source. Somehow Jacob is there too. Constantine dies before this. Lara kills Constantine on the way down.
Boss fight, baby. Well, not quite, but yeah.
It is. It's a silly boss fight. And the game actually, so rewinding back to Constantine, you have that boss fight with Constantine, and the game gives you the option to kill Constantine yourself or let him just like die, not through natural causes, but like the building is burning down.
Yeah, it doesn't save something's, him.
Yeah, something's always burning down in Tomb Raider. So it's either the choice of like, do you like out and out kill this guy or do you just kind of like let him die? Which feels weird to like in the 11th hour of this game give you a choice.
I think it's one of the, I mean, we could talk about Last of Us if you like.
yeah.
I think it's largely supposed to be, if I have to argue and defend it in some way, it's more of a, here is the moment that you have been building up to. You know that you're going to have to fight this guy and
yeah.
probably kill him. But now, having seen what Lara is as a character, would she do this? Do you think she would take vengeance because she is a survivor who does this? Or because she's seen the humanity of the people there, that she would spare him or not care for him because he's not worth her time?
Yeah, and all of that is good. All of that is like allowing the player to shape who Lara is as a character. Mm-hmm. But for that to be the only opportunity to ever do that, and I assume that that does not pay off at all in Shadow Probably of the not. Tomb Raider. Yeah, it was just a little strange.
Yeah, I would also say you could argue that the game is trying to go, here's the set piece. You can be a part of it or you can not be a part of it.
I guess.
It's strange. I don't think it's a conscious choice of like press X to save or press A to kill. It's just the game has to continue. We're not going to stop it here. So you either kill him now or we just let it happen. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just a little odd. But anyway, Lara continues into the city of Katesh. She finds the divine source, but she is surrounded by deathless guardians. Anna is there, and somehow Jacob is there. I don't remember how Jacob got there, but Lara has been, like, racing with Trinity to get here first to the Divine Source this whole time, so it tracks that Anna is there. I don't remember how Jacob got there. I finished this yesterday, by the way.
Yeah, the only thing I remember about the end specifically with that is Lara makes the most, like, death-defying moves in the last level get to the Divine Source. And then, like, yeah, the main characters just turn up because it's easy if you've got a helicopter or something.
Yeah.
Which, is always funny.
So you get the Divine Source. Anna, at first, like, gazes into it, and there's this weird, like, the only parallel I have is in Harry Potter when the Dementors show up and, like, suck the soul out of them. That's what it looks like with the Divine Swords.
You need to read more books.
Yeah, maybe.
That's the joke.
Anna, like, gazes into it. I've read plenty of books, and also fuck J.K. Rowling. Anyway, Anna, like, gazes into the Divine Source. The Deathless Guardians are, like, storming in to take it back from them. Anna decides to shoot her pistol at the Deathless Guardians, and she brought 3 bullets with her. Great plan. But ultimately, Lara decides to shatter the Divine Source, which kills all of the Deathless Guardians. It does also kill Jacob, but it allows her and Anna to escape safely. Then Anna is killed by a sniper, and in like a really silly storytelling moment, which I assume is just to lead into the sequel, the sniper also points their gun at Lara, and a voice says, like, not yet, we still have use for her. But Anna does, before she is killed, tell Lara that Trinity killed her father and that it wasn't a suicide. And Lara just talks about, like, going on her next adventure.
Yeah.
I felt the need to summarize the story in this game because this game is very focused on its story. And just, like, absolutely insane shit happens in this story at like every turn. And like, yeah, I think the story is at times a little incoherent, but on the whole was fine. Like, it was what I expected out of a Tomb Raider game, just based on like what I had played in the previous one of like, this is a fun action movie and I'm not going to think too deeply about it.
Yeah. I largely think of them as, well, the good ones anyway, is they have enough self-awareness to know that you're there to just go on the adventure rather than necessarily being coherent, because you've got deathless immortal beings. I don't think they need everything to sit properly. And also because they have audio logs and artifacts and stuff, they know that you're not going to get necessarily a whole picture. You will get like a good straight line, and some of it is just character motivated. Like, I don't need to know the details necessarily of the stigmata. I mean, you do.
But, I need to.
But it's more of a story told through characters and character actions. So why they do this, and you can clearly tell why the characters are motivated to do what they're doing, and that allows you to just escape into it, rather than being like, but wait a minute, couldn't they have just got hospital treatment and all of this stuff? So, yeah. I think not taking them too seriously.
Yeah, it just, as much as this game is focused on its characters, it was just a little disappointing to me that none of the characters from the previous game returned other than Jonah. Mm. And Jonah really doesn't get much character development. There's one moment where Jonah has the choice of shooting and killing Constantine, and it's honestly kind of a funny scene. Lara is like behind this glass and is like banging on the window, like, shoot him, kill him, because Lara is a murder machine and has killed like thousands of people.
I know.
Lara's like banging on the glass, like, kill him, kill him, kill him, he's a bad guy. And Jonah doesn't do it. And that's like the one moment where they're interested in like anything about Jonah's character at all. That's not just, yeah, Lara, I'll go on an adventure with you.
Yeah. It's not a good sequel if you wanted a direct sequel, because it doesn't care necessarily so much about the first game.
I felt that the first game cared about Lara's relationship with her crew members, that there was like a big storytelling component with her and Roth, who is like her kind of surrogate father figure.
Yes.
And then you had Jonah, you had Sam. There was two other characters that I don't remember, the like white nerdy guy. And then there was another woman. I don't remember their names, but like Lara had these, I'm not going to say deep relationships with these characters, but like a background history with these characters that like just added a little more depth to who Lara is. And this game does, like, I remember thinking to myself when I got to the Remnant Village in the like geothermal valley, I was like, yeah, it's kind of cool that there's like a town in this game, because you never get those moments of like peace in that first game. It's just like one action moment after another. And like, there's the only other people out there are threats to you. So it was like kind of interesting to be like, oh no, there's like a town here. There's like people to interact with. There's side missions and stuff in this game that the first game did not have. But I think that it suffered in the sense that Lara really doesn't develop a relationship with any of those characters except for Jacob and like Sophia a little bit, but really not much.
I think they were trying to largely avoid too much baggage. For my own take, like most games, you have to decide, is this going to be a sequel which playing the first game matters?
Right.
And if it does matter, then that means you have to, it's a harder job to introduce a newer audience to your sequel, because everyone, you want more people to play your game. And if they weren't convinced by the first one, you've got to convince them for the second. You want a larger audience share than before. So how do you do that in a trilogy? I mean, I presume they planned it as a trilogy or maybe further. And, well, you don't have the baggage of every character from the first game popping back up and being an integral part. Not to mention, if I remember right, most of Lara's friends die in that game anyway. So I'm pretty sure it's just...
I remember at least Sam made it out.
Yeah, Sam and... I've already forgotten his name.
Jonah.
Were like the two survivors. There might have been a third, but I'm pretty sure there were like, these were key moments in the first game of my friends have died, now I have to deal with the emotional baggage. I don't think they did deal with it well, but that's that game.
And there is the relationship with Anna, too, that is very central to this game and very important to this game. So, yeah, I think that your description of this as like a monster of the week thing is exactly right. They want you to be able just like to turn on this game and enjoy the story that's there and not have to have that background knowledge of what happened before. And that's fine. It just like, as somebody who enjoyed the first game and as somebody who has heard very much of Rise of the Tomb Raider, like that Rise of the Tomb Raider is so much better than the first game. I guess I was just expecting this game to build on the things that were sort of established in that first game.
I mentioned the Monster of the Week thing just because that is... I can't remember if every game in the Tomb Raider franchise has done that. Not all of them. Some have been direct sequels, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, you going with that mindset is bad. Not bad, bad, but annoying. And yeah, I didn't have a problem with that because I think... it was solid enough on its own that I didn't mind that it didn't follow on. I agree with the whole thing with Sam because that was, I mean, if we're going to talk characters quick and weird choices, Sam definitely was more of an integral character when it came to a comparison to Lara because she's like her best friend and like they spend a lot of time together. They seem like the obvious pair to bring together. I don't really get why they didn't bring her to the sequel and why they brought Jonah because... I think narratively, I get it in some ways. Like, oh, she needs to be protected because she'll be hunted down by Trinity, yada, yada. But I think largely there wasn't as much connection with Jonah. And I feel like they were trying... like, in Shadow of the Tomb Raider, the sequel to this, Jonah's in it again. And again, he's not, like, centrally important in a way. He is... I mean, in like in this game, when you mention, you know, Lara's like, shoot him, because she's now a... like a proper killer.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be her grounding in a way. He's the part of her that she no longer has and remind you, hey, this is all crazy. This is all madness. He's the only normal character in this whole game. So it's supposed to juxtapose there where I think Sam, because she's like some divine descendant of a goddess, it would have added, Himiko, and it would have added a lot more baggage, I think,
to try and
explain that. So I get it, but I agree, I don't like it. I feel like there would have been a good compromise somewhere.
I just think in the setup of this story being, because the story is interested in telling that kind of like PTSD narrative of like Lara coping with not having closure around her father's death, or not coping with it as it is. And then also like her still not maybe totally processing what happened to her in the first game. I feel like a good setup to that would be to have Sam appear in like an early cutscene or something telling Lara, like, you need to stop and like think about all these things and like maybe get some therapy. Because like this story wants to say that Lara is like going too far, she's going too hard, that like the game wants that to be a like story that they're telling, that I feel like having Sam be that person to Lara of being like, hey, I'm your really close friend and I can see that you're not well. And that could explain why she's not on this journey with Lara, that Sam says like, well, if you're going to do this, I can't be a part of it because you're like not, this is not healthy for you. Jonah then stands in as like the kind of character who will say like, I don't think this is healthy, but I'm going to stand by you no matter what. And I'm going to go along for the ride with you, which makes it even more meaningful when he does get injured and you're like worried he's going to die. Then it's like Lara then has to process it of like, he is here because I pushed him to be here. And like my actions have consequences and put my friends in danger. I just feel like that would have like completed the storytelling a little bit more and given it that connection to the first game. But maybe I'm expecting a little bit too much out of the Tomb Raider Survivor trilogy.
I think largely, again, these games are not too serious. Like, they know that they are a bit pulpy and a bit silly, so they're not going to be completely perfect in its narrative sense.
Yeah.
Sorry. They're not completely bothered by being that. They just want you to have the feeling of an adventure. There's not the larger narrative arc, I suppose, that they care about, which is fine. I feel like it still works for them. It's just a choice that, maybe not everyone is a big fan of, which I get.
And I still enjoyed the narrative. I still liked this game. I would play the third game. I haven't heard amazing things about it, so I'm not like rushing on to it. Ross is shaking his head. I liked this game. I liked the first game. I'm not going to say that like this is my favorite game in the whole world, but I think it was good and I would easily recommend it to other people. I do want to talk a bit about gameplay.
Yes.
The experience of playing it, because we've been very story focused so far. I will say, like the first game, this game has an amazing way of like triggering every anxiety that I have. Lara is constantly put in these like dire situations and is like thrown on the ground and like falls from, you know, like several stories high where she should like break her back. And then she like gets up and limps for a couple seconds and then is running around again.
Yeah.
But one specific, like, my greatest fear is being trapped under ice. That Ooh. Is like the number one. It freaks me out when it happens in movies. I like close my eyes. I leave the room because I'm deathly, deathly afraid of it. And this game does it in the first like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So like that was one of those things where I was like, damn, I'm glad I'm not wearing my smartwatch because I'm trying to get my resting heart rate down and this would not help it. So this game does do that, and it does kind of increase the immersion, I would say. It does start to feel a little silly when Lara is, like, doing these death-defying stunts and, like, throwing herself all over the place and just, like, keeps getting back up unscathed. But it does do that well. I do not care for, though, and the first game did this as well, when you die in this game... And like, let's say you get caught in like a strong river rapid and you get taken by it and like crash against a rock. It shows you that happening in like gruesome detail.
Yep.
Hated it in the first game and I don't like it here. I know a lot of games do it, but like something about Lara being a young woman protagonist, it just feels very like torture porn to me.
Oh, I get you. It's weird in a way because if I remember right, the only other big game of that time that had done those before had been the Dead Space games. At least that's my memory anyway.
Last of Us does it.
Okay, so yes, let's keep those both in mind. Last of Us and Dead Space. Now, both of them deal with horror and mutants and a horrid world to sort of inhabit. Right. And I get that that's the point they're trying to go with these Tomb Raider games, but at the same time, it's like... Like, sure, there's deathless ones, which are, like, immortal warriors that have gone silly, but it's not the same, because most of the experience is the idea of Lara surviving and Lara dealing with the elements, and, you know, if she makes one bad move, boom, she's dead. In those games, if I remember right, you die from enemy attacks, and they're quite gruesome kill finishers. This is, I failed a sequence, here's a gruesome death.
Yes.
It's not like it's an act of someone else doing it to you, it's... You failed. You got Lara killed.
And half the time that these happen, you're like in a tomb. Like you're just solving a puzzle and it's like, oops, that cliff was too high. And now I have to watch Lara like fall onto some stakes or something. When you die in like one of the gunfight sequences, Lara just kind of like falls to the ground. It's not this like gruesome ass scene. It's just these like environmental deaths where you get these horrible scenes.
It delves straight into like gore horror, which is not really what the game is going for. So they do just seem completely out of place.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument that like Last of Us is gory. Like it's a disgusting thing when you look at just some of the enemy designs and things and it fits in that universe. Do I like watching it? Of course not. But but here it feels totally out of place. It's like I was doing this cheerful little puzzle and then all of a sudden I have to look at Lara get like stabbed through the neck.
it's not pleasant for sure.
Yeah.
I wish that had not happened, but it's now a trope of that trilogy in a way.
Yeah, so speaking about the puzzles in this game, I enjoyed the puzzles in this game. It did feel like there were more puzzles. I remember that being a big complaint with the first one of like, there's not that many tombs, and the game's called Tomb Raider. Yeah, so this game did feel like it had more, and I enjoyed them. Mm-hmm. I will say that I got some bugs, and one really major one. I was doing a tomb, the excavation shaft tomb. I'm not saying that because I think you'll remember it in specificity, but just so that our listeners know, I was doing the excavation shaft tomb, and there is a sequence where you have to pull these mine carts down off of a track.
Oh, I do still remember this.
I was running around that tomb. I was doing a bunch of things. I saw... And this game has the thing, you have like Batman vision in this game, inexplicably. It's just the like, oh, we're going to highlight the things in the environment that you can like interact with. And it's more for just like utility and ease. And I'm happy that it's in there. I'm not critiquing that. But so I'm like, I'm looking around, I'm hitting that all the time. I'm like, I cannot figure out what to do. And I do try, this sounds silly in the context of our Link to the Past episode, but like I do genuinely try to complete puzzles like on my own first. And the puzzles in the Tomb Raider games are like not that hard, where I generally am able to complete them no problem on my own. So I was like, I was in this tomb, I swear, I must have been like an hour. And I was like, what the fuck am I supposed to be doing? So eventually I like relented and Googled it and found out that I was supposed to be pulling these mine carts. They did not load in. I had to exit the game and load back into my save to get them to load in. And then once I saw them, I'm like, oh, of course that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And I would have figured that out if the minecarts were just there. So like that was a big thing that like it wasn't game breaking, obviously, because I could just like exit and then go back in and it was fine. But like that's a pretty big thing to not happen. I got another bug as well. This one is sillier, but I was trying to do a challenge that's in the game where you jump off of like high waterfalls and stuff and do a swan dive into the water. I was doing one of those challenges. First of all, it's so hard to do a goddamn swan dive. I was like, I spent a lot of time trying to do this challenge. At one point, I did a successful swan dive and crashed into the rocks below and died there and got a lovely little death scene for it. When I loaded back in, the waterfall effect, like the mist and the rain and everything and the color, that was everywhere. I was just forever inside of the waterfall, even if I was far away from this waterfall. So like, yeah, like I just, it was weird to me that I encountered a number of bugs. Those were the two that I really remembered. But yeah, nothing game breaking, but just like little things that I was like, that kind of made this difficult to complete. But yeah, I did enjoy the puzzles. And aside from that one excavation shaft one, I didn't have any like real trouble completing any of them.
Do you feel like they were varied enough, or were you looking forward to the next one? Do you think like it?
I said this in the pitch that I was really into the like collectathon bullshit in the first game. And so for me, always like completing the tombs was like, ooh, what am I going to get for finishing this tomb? Or like this gets me further on my percentage of things complete in this area. So like that is my main motivator of completing these things, not necessarily like the satisfaction of completing the puzzle. But yeah, I thought that they were fairly varied. I mean, it was usually pretty obvious of what I was supposed to be doing. And most of the time it was like, OK, it's just about like executing this and getting the timing right. Some things were not super clear. Like at one point you get a grappling hook and it wasn't always clear like what I could and could not grapple onto. So I did die at some stupid points because it was like, oh, I was sliding down this thing and I was supposed to grapple, but I didn't see the grapple thing. So I just died and now I have to reload back in. But yeah, otherwise I thought that the puzzles were good.
Cool. I might be right in thinking this. It's been a while, but don't all of the tombs give you... So at the end of them, you find like a tablet or whatever and it gives you... Yeah, a codex. And it gives you a skill point or something? Because there is...
You get actually a skill that you cannot unlock normally through the skill tree. It's like a special thing that you get for finishing the tomb. So like one of them was I got the ability to climb faster, or I got the ability to see traps with my Batman vision, which would let me like activate them and not get stuck in them. So like nothing that fundamentally changes the game. They're mostly like ease things, like quality of life things that are meaningful. Like they do meaningfully impact it, but it's not like if you decide that you don't want to do any of the tombs, it's not like you can't complete the story or like it's exceptionally difficult without them.
Yeah, I was just curious because I remember playing it and that was very much a motivator, discovery of something that, this is something I can't get elsewhere, and it's unique and not massively changes the game experience, but I felt it also narratively linked in the whole idea of, I mean, learning from ancient tablets is stupid, but whatever.
Lara reads this little thing and suddenly gets the ability to climb like 100% faster.
Yeah, it's just like, oh, ancient technology is so good.
I just needed that little bit of information and then I'm able to do more physical feats.
Yeah. But I liked the idea of, you know, the more that you're doing to explore tombs, the more you're actually developing as a Tomb Raider, you know, you're becoming a better survivalist or a better, you know, well-rounded character, which, yeah, I just remember being quite satisfying and fulfilled the fantasy of Lara Croft, you know, being a Tomb Raider.
Yeah. On the inverse of that, though, is the combat in the game. Because, this game, it feels like it's at battle with itself. You know, like, there are the sections that are very much about exploration and traversal. And, like, the set pieces usually play into that of, like, you have to jump at the right time and, like, use your grappling hook at the right time and rope this thing. And so those all feel, I lump those in with the traversal, with the puzzles. And then there's just occasionally, like, shooting gallery sections of this game where it's just like you just got to mow down a bunch of guys to get to the next area. And that I would say is my biggest pain point with this game. I had a lot of trouble with them early on. As you get more and more tools and weapons, they get a lot easier, which makes sense. But by the end, it, like, the combat is a joke and you're just like, I'm a killing machine. I did play this on the normal difficulty though, so maybe that was like, I could have had more of a challenge if I wanted it, but like, I don't play these games for the combat. I don't need to enjoy the combat in Tomb Raider. Most of the time I approach the combat sections just doing it as stealth. Like, I'm a big bow user, I'm a big like, let me hide, and that usually just seems like the path of least resistance with these games. There's some resource scarcity, but not much. They kind of just like ply you with ammo at every turn. And you do have some fun tools at your disposal of like creating traps and bombs and like handheld throwing items. The game is littered, by the way, with like cans and bottles because you can craft those into like handheld explosives. They are all over the place. In areas where it does not make sense for there to be cans and bottles, like, say, the ancient city of Katesh, I found, like, straight up, like, whiskey bottles down there, which feels silly, but they are there. Yeah. And I know that's one of those things where I have to, like, turn off my brain a little bit, but it is silly that they're
down there. I mean, the thing is, you can explain some of that away a bit based on, like, maybe the Soviets were exploring here and then a group of them died here and that's all that's left is their leftover cans and bottles. But
and sometimes they do try to do that. Like, occasionally there's like an audio log next to like a skeletal body and it's like, oh, I left my things here. So like sometimes they do try to do that. And other times it's like, okay, well, this is just where there's a combat section. So we got to give you the item. So it's fine. But
yeah it's still got all the tropes of a game. But
I play these games mostly through stealth just because that feels easy to just like line up a headshot here and there. Although, the gameplay is fine. It's fine. It's not like I don't look forward to the combat sections. I don't like feel a satisfaction when I clear it. It's more like, okay, I'm excited to get to the next area. I'm excited to do the next tomb, to pick up the next collectible, or to get to the next story beat. It's just like they're there as a utility.
Here's a question then, because a lot of the design of the world and the levels, so the game is sort of a loose open world-ish experience. Essentially, what you do, I mean, it's Metroidvania-like, which for most people is essentially, because you have to explain these, because I hate that it's based on two games. Anyway, enough with my pet peeves. A Metroidvania-style game is essentially one where you progress by unlocking more gear and equipment in order to overcome very specific challenges that block you from progressing. But a lot of those same gears, techniques, and whatever that you learn throughout the course of the game are also things that are blocked. Side areas are blocked by these in earlier sections. So it gives you the idea of like, oh, now I have this. I can go back to much earlier in the game and unlock this thing because I now have the equipment or the skill. But specifically for this game, a lot of what happens is you're accessing these new areas once you get the equipment, and then a story beat happens in said area, and then that area becomes accessible for you to explore. There's no real connection to the story. You've gone past that. That level's unlocked for you to go back to. There's enemies there. There's maybe some side quest stuff here and there. But largely, you're progressing forward all the time, but you have the option to go back with what you level up with. So I'm curious, did you actually, like, explore any of that? Yes. Or did you just... Oh, cool.
Because that's my, like, collect-a-thon shit. I would, like, constantly, like, okay, let me advance the story a little bit, and now I just got rope arrows. So, like, let me go back and do everything I can do with my rope arrows. Or, like, you get broadhead climbing arrows, which let you like shoot into wood and use the arrows to climb, which somebody please explain to me the physics of Lara Croft being able to climb on arrows and put her full body weight on them. But turning off my brain, yeah, that is something that I love about this game and something that I do a lot in games. I'm playing Jedi Fallen Order at the same time as I'm playing this game, and that game also very much does this. And like, it's to the point where I piss Joe off because we're playing Jedi Fallen Order together, where I'm like, oh, let's go back and get all the treasures on this planet. He's like, can we just please like finish the story in this game? And so yesterday, knowing that we were going to probably record today, I was like, I just need to finish Tomb Raider and like stop with the collectibles and stop with the exploration. I do think that I will go back and do a lot of that stuff because I enjoy that. But yeah, that's a big pull for me in this game.
Yeah, the reason I ask is because from what I remember in my experience, a lot of, again, talking about the like holistic nature of the game, a lot of what I remember was I could recognize areas in the game, quite distinct areas, because the levels themselves are laid out in a specific way, and there's a lot of good indicators of like, oh, here's something I can't like get through at the moment, I'll come back. And a lot of that made me actually like engage with the environment a lot more than if it had simply just been, right, this is one set piece, move on. Like, I was exploring these areas and caring about them more than if it had just been a straight run through, which is actually one of those problems that I have with the Uncharted games. I know you haven't played them, but because they just jump from set piece to set piece to set piece, you don't get that sense of getting to look at the environment much, except when there's puzzles. So this is a game that utilizes it not only in the puzzle sections, but also in the combat and the exploration in general, which, yeah, just it made the game feel more like, hey, I'm playing as Lara Croft, who is having to figure out her environment, upgrade her gear to survive better, and eventually become, yeah, a killing machine.
And I think that it helps, too, because this game is such a thrill ride that it helps occasionally be like, okay, I just did like a lot of story beats, a lot of stuff happened, so now I'm going to take like some quiet time and like go back and do some of that stuff. And so it pads out the experience time wise, because I think if you just mainline story, this game would not be very long. So it pads out the time, but it also like, I think that it goes a long way to your experience, where I'm thinking about what you're saying about the Uncharted games. I'm like, I feel like that would just get exhausting to go from set piece to set piece to set piece. And I know that as the Uncharted series went on with like Uncharted 4 and Lost Legacy, that they eventually did do some like more open areas where you would do more exploration and more interaction. But to me, that's like a key thing in these Tomb Raider games of like, oh, okay, I just did the story and now I got the rebreather, so I'm going to go back and do the things that I know that I couldn't get to until I had the rebreather. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah, if you really don't like it being a gun first, the Uncharted games, and probably not for you, then...
Yeah, I've always debated whether to play it, because, like, obviously I liked the first Tomb Raider so much that everybody was like, oh, you should play Uncharted, because that game is really, like, aping a lot of what Uncharted does.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about it, and I do own all of them, I think, through just, like, PlayStation Plus giveaways and stuff, but I've always said, like, if I'm going to try Uncharted, I think I'd like to do Uncharted The Lost Legacy, which is the one that had the two female protagonists. Yes. And as far as I know, had those, like, more open areas.
Not sure, personally. That was the only one I've not played. But that's because by the end of Uncharted 4, I was like, this series, I'm done. But yeah.
Yeah, I think Naughty Dog is too, so.
Yeah, so I think it mostly fulfills that. I'm also curious, did you ever play any of the DLC? You probably didn't, because you just said you had to power through.
Kind of, toward the end there. So I did start on the Baba Yaga DLC, because I found the character who was like trapped in a locker, who you free, and she tells you like, oh, my grandfather is trapped in this thing. And there are side missions in this game. Like, there are characters who tell you like, oh, I got separated from some of my party, and could you go and clear out that cave of wolves and free them? And so when I first met her, I thought it was just like one of those small side missions. So I was like, oh, let me go do that. As I got a little bit deeper into it, I realized like, oh, no, this is like a full DLC. This is taking me off into like a totally different area and into a different story thread. So part of me was like, let me focus on finishing the main game. And part of me, I was very early on in the game when I got to that. I was like maybe a third of the way through the game. I was conscious of like, there are tools out there that I do not have, and weapons that I do not have. So I was kind of like, let me maybe come back to this when I feel like a little bit better equipped to do it. because I was still kind of struggling with combat at that point in the game, because I didn't have a lot of like weapons and stuff. So I saw some of it, but I didn't do any of it. I do think that I will go and play it, and maybe we do a follow-up like part two episode where we talk about some of the DLC.
Yeah, potentially, if you're interested.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only reason I ask is because this was from memory and also looking at a list of the DLC. A lot of the DLC went into either narrative elements or gameplay experiences, both of which I think are quite strong. I know you had issues with the combat side of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So you've only done the Baba Yaga one, but there's like five DLCs.
Wow.
Yeah, I guess I want to bring these up just because I'm now tempted to see if you'd want to try them. You probably won't, but I'm gonna go down there. So yeah, like the Baba Yaga one, and there's Blood Ties, which is Blood Ties is you explore Croft Manor looking for your father's like will to prove that Lara owns the Croft Manor because it's getting seized.
Oh, that sounds fun. I like that as a story setup.
Yeah. It's one of those, like, exploring Lara's childhood, past, whatever stuff, which is, yeah, like, a nice little bit extra. I remember thinking of that pretty fondly. And then, yeah, the Baba Yaga one, which is very much a fantastical interpretation of the largely Eastern European storytelling of Baba Yaga the witch, who lives in a house with chicken feet and stuff, and, yeah, puts it in the Tomb Raider world.
Mm-hmm.
And I found like both of them were enjoyable enough. I felt that Blood Ties, the Croft Manor one, was a lot more interesting. The fantastical elements are a bit give or take for me in the series. Like the stuff with Jacob's interesting, I find, because he's the first character that has to deal with having mystical powers in one of these Tomb Raider games, which you hadn't really seen before. Usually it's like the MacGuffin that people are aiming to get. Well, this is a character who is... had it and lived through it for 100 of years, and you get that perspective.
Yeah.
So I think they're both enjoyable, but I am curious if I can tempt you with either of these. So there's one DLC, which is Lara's Nightmare, which is essentially a zombie horde in Croft Manor. It's not really... It was the last DLC. It's one of those like last hurrahs of, we've got all this Croft Manor assets, we should really make something else. So they went, here's the story, here's the combat DLC, right? Kept them separate and interesting. Extend the life of the game, I imagine. But the one that I found interesting, actually the two I found interesting, I remember now. First was the endurance mode. Now, this was interesting in a way, because the general game is, like I say, action-adventure, combat, stealth, exploration. And this sort of takes those elements, but puts them into... not exactly a roguelike, you know, your new favorite genre.
Yeah.
But
I'm still playing Vampire Survivors, for the record. Go on.
Nice. But it gives you a procedurally generated forest where you have tombs and caves and scavenge relics and stuff. And essentially you are trying to survive in the cold. So it's very much a survival action game. Okay. And it's a lot more, I would say, closer to a roguelike. I don't think it's pure roguelike, but you essentially have to kill enemies to scavenge items. You don't regenerate health quite easily. It's basically hard mode in a way, you know, like they're adding a lot more elements that you have to keep yourself alive with, whilst also discovering these upgrades that you can get as time goes on. So, you know, the tombs give you abilities, and these abilities make it easier to survive. And you're trying to do this as long as possible. There's no real story to it. It's just you're plopped down in this forest. But I found it really interesting because, personally, I find it really interesting when an existing game pivots its genre a bit to try and do something radically different with the same mechanics. So I think I've mentioned it on the podcast before, but Prey, the game by Arkane, had a DLC / spin-off, I don't know, called Prey Mooncrash, which was taking the... gameplay of Prey, which was very much more methodical and careful, I suppose, in a way, of a first-person shooter-ish, and then putting it into a roguelike genre, and I felt that really worked. And I really liked what Rise did here, which was give you, here's the endurance thing, and thematically it worked because Lara Croft. And even more interestingly, it gave you a co-op version of this later on. Now, I never played that, but just Not that it's exciting to think about co-op necessarily, but I do like that there is a real push to something. Like, I love when DLC gives a testing ground of what another game in the series could be like. It's very much like the little dipping in toes to figure out, does this work for a genre or doesn't it? And it's still enjoyable largely because it has to be designed to be sold. But yeah, I just found that cool.
So can I ask, though, with the co-op, I assume it's online co-op, not local.
I believe so, yes.
Will it still work? Because there was multiplayer in this game and it is shut off. Like, the servers are not active when you try to interact. Because this game, by the way, as I was playing it, it kept plying me with credits and playing cards, which I assume had something to do with the multiplayer mode when it was in there. But you also get this little message in the menu of like, your Square Enix membership functionality is gone. This no longer works. So if it is online co-op, I think that might not work anymore because Eidos is no longer a part of Square Enix. And I think once they severed ties, all that stuff got turned off.
Is this the Rise of the Tomb Raider 20th anniversary? Because yes. Okay. So yeah, that's the latest one. So I can only imagine that yes.
Okay.
It could be working. It's very hard to tell, honestly, because this would have been a game from, 7-ish years ago now. So the servers being on that long, and as you say, with the developers and publishers splitting here and there, probably not, but I don't know. It's worth trying if you can.
Okay. Yeah, I do want to go back and take a look at the other DLC, so I will give that a try and let you know if it is functional.
Yeah. And last but not least, the one which... Yeah. Also made me really enjoy my time. So I don't often go back to a game for its DLC and stick with that DLC. You know, more often than not, the game itself, the main game, is the enjoyable part because it's had years of development, loads of depth to it put in, and DLC is usually a lot of a shorter, sharper, sort of contained thing. So the next combat-ish DLC, focus combat DLC, was called Cold Darkness Awakened. Now, the premise is Lara must shut down a Soviet chemical weapon plant that's been reactivated by Trinity.
Okay.
And it's turned people, I think specifically, I might need to check this, specifically only men into zombies.
Okay.
So the idea is, like, Sophia, I think she can pilot a helicopter as well. It's weird, but Sophia drops off Lara to shut down the plant and, like, survive against these zombie-like people. And, yeah, it's just... It's that survivor... that endurance mode thing of trying to survive, but shifted a little bit to be more of a... like a timed event. You're trying to shut down this reactor before it, you know, goes nuclear, and it's randomly procedured... It's procedurally generated each time, so your task that you have to do is a bit different. Your side objectives are a bit different, where items are a bit different. So you still largely have a map which you can focus on, and it focuses on stealth because, like most zombie spin-off type things at the time, these things could kill you pretty quick if they overwhelm you. So it gave a... It's stupid as a premise, but it gave a interesting, again, twist on the game. And looking back at it, I think it was a case of they were trying to figure out if this was a viable thing. Maybe they were testing it for another game at the studio at the time. But yeah, I actually found, even if that wasn't the case, and they said, no, it was all unique, I was like, I would believe that. I wouldn't believe that they were doing this as something extra. But yeah, I just found it really interesting as a premise.
Yeah.
And the experience itself was really... I kept doing runs because I wanted to see what the variations would be. And... could I do better next time? You know, that sort of thing.
So, I'm sorry, what is that called?
That's called Cold Darkness Awakened.
Okay. All right. Because I looked up something else related to the multiplayer. That does sound interesting, though. I like it when games kind of, as you said, take that DLC as an opportunity to experiment with something new and, like, do something totally different. So I'm interested in that. I did look up the thing about the multiplayer. So this game did not have multiplayer. I was wrong. I'm going to read off of scholarly journal wikipedia.org. Sorry. This game introduces expeditions, which allow players to replay the game with new constraints and requirements. The game has four modes: chapter replay elite, score attack, and remnant resistance. Chapter replay and chapter replay elite allows players to replay any level, and Elite allows them to bring already acquired skills and weapons to the level. Score Attack introduces score combo chains to the game, which is actually in there to an extent. You get more XP for like chaining together similar kills. But then Remnant Resistance allows players to create custom scenarios, which can then be shared with other players. By completing expeditions, players can earn credits, which then can be used to purchase digital collectible cards to modify the gameplay. Common cards may be used only once, and foil cards can be used repeatedly. The cards can also be purchased in microtransactions. So I think the microtransactions have been turned off for this game, but the cards and stuff are still there. And the game just kind of like plies you with a bunch of credits so that you can do them. So yeah, it sounds like there's a lot more to this game than just the main narrative, which is a little odd to like tack all of that on. And like, I question the development time that was maybe spent on some of these extra modes that most people would not really touch. But
yeah,
sure.
I think this is why I like it, because it is such an aberrant post-development type of game. It feels like, I need to stop using my feelings as a way to talk about this game, but it feels like the devs had downtime, they didn't have a project maybe to jump over to, or they were told, look, we need to release more DLC for this game, but we also need to come up with some like provable ideas for another game.
Yeah.
Combine those two as your... Yeah, combine those two to try and figure something out.
Yeah.
And yeah, just like having a complete arcade mode type experience, and then separate roguelike elements, its own mini procedurally generated thing. All of these things are just so away from the main story. It made the game a lot more deep than I think it was ever going to be. And I don't mean it deep in like a satisfying way, potentially, but deep in just this game can offer a lot to different people. You don't need to be in there for the story. There's loads of story if you want to. You don't need to be in there for the gameplay, but there is loads of gameplay options if you want it. And if you buy like the Rise, the one with all the DLC, you have a lot of variation there.
Yeah.
I think you can buy it for fairly cheap price now. So it's not like you're losing out. You probably will find something in there to enjoy. And I just found that impressive.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. And that maybe my kind of final thought is that everything that I've ever heard about this game is that like, it does so much more than the first game, and it improves upon like just about everything that the first game established, to the point where, like, as you said in the pitch, like this is of those three games in the Survivor trilogy, this is the one that is easy to recommend and that like just about anybody can play and probably enjoy. When I finished it, I was like, yeah, I thought that was really good and definitely improved upon the first game, but it kind of felt like more of the first. But now hearing about all of this DLC and all of these different modes that they've put in here, like now this is starting to sound more in line with what I've heard about it, that it's like a very full and complete package. And I'm excited to try more of it.
Yay. You like a game.
Occasionally like that happens. I really liked this game. Like the story is kind of batshit insane at points, but it's enjoyable. It's a fun ride to go through, and I've got lots more collect-a-thon bullshit to do, which is always what I enjoy. So
that's good to hear. And as a closing note, if you ever feel compelled to play Shadow of the Tomb Raider, we should probably maybe we should do a reverse of our regular format. I'm going to try and pitch you not to play it.
That would be fun. I would like to. I own it. I think I have it on both PlayStation. I think it was free on PlayStation Plus at one point, and the DLC was on sale for like $3. So I was like, I guess I'll just get the DLC too. And then I think it was free on Epic at one point as well. So I have it on both PC and PS4. I have not heard stellar things about it, and your attitude kind of reinforces that to me. But I liked this one, so I have to finish the Survivor trilogy. How will I know if Lara survives?
Yeah, who can tell?
It's not like every season of Survivor was good. I still watched all those damn things.
Again, this is why I think it would be interesting to switch the formula of this pitch and play.
So, yeah. Dark pitch and play. Don't play this game.
Pitch and unplay.
Yeah. So I think that takes us to the pitch for our next game for you to play, Ross, which is Tony Hawk's American Wasteland.
Radical.
Yeah. So Tony Hawk's American Wasteland came out in, I think, 2005. It of course, a fine Activision product developed by longtime Tony Hawk developer Neversoft, which, by the way, I only learned very recently what that name, Neversoft, is a joke. I never got it. I played these games as a child, so I guess I wouldn't have understood it, but boy, howdy.
You get the feeling of the dude bros, don't you?
Yeah.
God, so, the 90s, man.
This game came out in 2005. It was a cross-gen title, I want to say. It was like GameCube, PS2, Xbox era, and then I think that it eventually came out on the 360, I want to say.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, and it was released on the PC. There were also DS and GBA versions of it, and I assume, I believe they were very different than the product that was available on the other platforms. But
for younger listeners, that happened quite a lot. Because the handhelds did not have the power to make a 3D game.
Yes, and when we get into playing some of the Sims games, we will absolutely talk about that. But anyway, so Tony Hawk is an interesting series because, of course, it started with Tony Hawk's Pro Skater, and they did Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2, 3, and 4. After Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 4, they decided to kind of change up the formula, whereas those previous games, the Pro Skater games, were very much focused on, like, skating challenges, levels, and that was it.
Arcadey.
Yeah, they were very arcadey, and they continued to be arcadey in the gameplay, but after Pro Skater 4, they kind of did, like, I want to say a reset for the series and did Tony Hawk's Underground, which had a story, which is not something that was, like, in the Pro Skater games. It still maintained the core gameplay, but it was more of, like, a story that you were playing through, and you still had the challenges in there. So Tony Hawk's Underground came out, then there was Underground 2, which was, like, Viva La Bam and Jackass inspired, and we could have long conversations about that. But then it was followed up by American Wasteland. And American Wasteland abandoned, at least to some extent, the, like, Jackass vibes of Underground 2. They're still very much present in here. But American Wasteland is kind of like, I would say, the last good Tony Hawk game. You're making a face. But at least from a gameplay perspective, I would say American Wasteland is the last good Tony Hawk game.
Okay.
Yeah. So I really love this game. I played it because I'm a big fan of the Tony Hawk series. I started with, like, Pro Skater 2, played a bit of Pro Skater 3. Pro Skater 4 was the one that I, like, really, really heavily played. And then Underground was, like, the one that I was like, yeah, this is a Tony Hawk game. This is so good. So I loved Underground. I played a lot of Underground 2 and did enjoy it. Unfortunately, I was also, like, into Viva La Bam at the time. So I was like, this rocks. That opinion has changed over time, but I still have a soft spot in my heart for American Wasteland. I think it tells a fun story, and I think that it has, like, some of the best Tony Hawk gameplay. There's a lot of bullshit tacked onto it, but it's still, like, fun, enjoyable Tony Hawk-ass gameplay.
So just to explain Jackass, because that was a very early 2000s thing.
Did that have, like, cultural penetration in the UK, or is that, like, an American-ass thing? Okay.
Jackass did. I don't know what Viva La Bam is, but...
Oh, okay. We can talk about Viva La Bam in a few minutes. But
to explain the Jackass format, how do I describe it? A group of, I believe, young 20-something, think mostly white guys from, I believe, the West Coast, mostly as well, but maybe a collection of people. Basically would film themselves doing stunts is the kindest word I could put for it, and pranks. But essentially they would do stupid stuff like, I don't know, shoot me repeatedly in the body with a beanbag gun or in the balls with a beanbag gun. And that was entertainment. It was basically a test of, can I endure this or how can I wreak havoc on my body? Can I car surf? And all of these other really stupid and dangerous things generally, which no medical professional, I imagine, would tell you, yeah, that's fine. Oh, I can't imagine what the Jackass doctors were like. That would just... I advise you not to do this, Steve-O.
Some of the people who were on Jackass have, like, continued health problems from the things that, like, Johnny Knoxville is all kinds of fucked up. There were a lot of drugs and alcohol obviously associated with this. And I know that this sounds like an insane thing, but for the era, like, this absolutely fit in with the era. Like, this was when Punk'd was on MTV. So, like, prank stuff was a thing and were not considered, like, mean-spirited, horrible things to do. I'm sure there were people saying that at the time, but, like, this was popular culture. Like, the Jackass movies were successful. So to clear up the Viva La Bam thing, Viva La Bam was an outgrowth of Jackass because one of the people involved with the Jackass movies was Bam Margera, who was also a skateboarder. So he got a MTV TV series called Viva La Bam, which was very much like continuing the Jackass format of like pranks and doing stupid stuff and like hurting yourself. It had some skateboarding mixed in with it, and it kind of centered around like Bam's family and friends at the time. It was a terrible TV show that I watched so much of, but I was not allowed to watch Jackass, so I had to watch the version that was like on TV, which was Viva La Bam.
Yep, that sounds about right for the the decade.
Yeah. So American Wasteland is still an outgrowth of that, I would say. Underground 2 is Jackass. Like, it is Jackass, but a Tony Hawk game. American Wasteland is at least trying to tell like some semblance of a story. It did also an interesting thing about it, because like you can't talk about Tony Hawk games without talking about the music with Tony Hawk games. So American Wasteland did have a soundtrack, and the soundtrack included on it was a lot of like punk and emo bands at the time covering, like, I would say classic punk songs. Like, there were covers of like Clash songs and Black Flag, and by groups such as like Fall Out Boy and My Chemical Romance and Rise Against, and like Alkaline Trio, like bands that were popular at the time. So it is going into it, I will warn you, it is very much of the era. It is very much a 2005 vertical slice, but it meant a lot to me in 2005. I really liked this game. I played it a whole lot.
Yeah, I mean, so for a little context, I'm pretty sure I've played American Wasteland before, but
okay, to completion.
I remember. So I did have a lot of. So I never had much of a background in the Tony Hawk Pro Skater games, which were the when everyone was raving about them, I guess. I did start from Underground, and it was a really weird story I'm about to go into in a way, but the only reason that I got into them is, so back during the Xbox, the original Xbox era, when I would go on holiday with my family when I was, I don't know, 10, 11, something like that, there was one game store on the coast, nowhere near I live, and I just popped in, I guess, one day with my mum, and she got talking to the guy behind the counter, and I don't know if he offered it on the wall or if he just told her. But he offered the opportunity because he was selling imported games. So that's how it came up. And he essentially, because a lot of the consoles were region locked, he offered to do a chip service, which would allow you to play all regions. And
this place has been shut down. There's no way that this place is still in business.
No, I mean, it's a video game store. It definitely is not in business. But it also like had loads of downloaded emulated games from past consoles and stuff from the Mega Drive and whatever. But long story short, the other heinous thing about this chip as well is you could put in a game disc. You could then write it to the hard drive and you would have the copy of the game.
Okay.
So
this is also why that place went out of business.
Yeah, it does seem mad looking back at it, but it did mean like at Blockbusters and stuff, I would weekly go in, get a game rented for £2 or something, a full game, download the thing, and then I would just return it in the next few days. And yeah, that was it.
And you were a minor when all of these crimes were committed, so there's absolutely no way you can be convicted for that.
I mean, in all honesty, if anyone is worried about the financial state of most of these studios that have shut down or been absorbed,
Also, Activision is doing just fine.
So. Yes. Yeah. Oh no, poor Activision. But long story short, it meant that I, for the first time, really explored a lot more genres of games, because it was a pretty cheap, like, in. So I never necessarily cared about the Tony Hawk games, but I tried them. And the first one was Tony Hawk's Underground. And I remember really loving that at the time.
Underground's great.
Yeah.
I stand by that. Underground is great. You heard it here. 2023, Tony Hawk's Underground is good.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how it holds up. That might be something to explore. But yeah. I remember being, I cared about that one. And I remember playing Thug 2. That they actually have really, because TH for Tony Hawk, great, yeah. Like when you abbreviate it, great, like
so, yeah, Thug is Tony Hawk's Underground and Thaw is, yeah. American Wasteland.
Yeah, just great. Yeah. But I remember playing American Wasteland just because it was a game that was, I believe, selling itself on you could skate everywhere infinitely.
Yeah, so that was a big marketing push for this game, was that it was like one big world and no loading screens. We can talk about that when you play it.
Yeah, I remember that bit of it, but I don't remember much else. I do remember it was completely stylistically different in a way to the Thug games, because...
Yeah, to an extent.
Yeah, the Thug games were trying to be... Well, at least the first one was trying to be more grounded, I suppose. Yeah. And then Thug 2 is its own thing, which we could mention. But American Wasteland, I guess, went for a bit more of an overtop arcadey, like it went back to the original. And I remember not liking that much. So I'm curious to see if playing it again changes my mind. So, yeah, I guess the only question I've really got is, when was the last time you played it? Because I'm wondering what judgment, how much nostalgia is here?
Probably like 2008, 2009. So a lot of nostalgia, a lot of nostalgia.
That makes sense.
I definitely do remember it very well because I played it so much. Mm. But yeah, a lot of nostalgia. And 2008, 2009, like, emo was still kind of alive and well in suburban, yep, America. So, yeah, it was of that era. And also, to be clear, I have always wanted to be a skateboarder. That's, like, my dream. I grew up watching Rocket Power and playing the Tony Hawk games, and skateboarding, yeah, was just, like, the coolest shit in the world to me. I have a scar on my elbow from a failed attempt. And a little while ago, I just saw a reductress thing on Twitter that was like a woman afraid that she's no longer young enough to like skateboard. And that really is like, I have always wanted to be a skateboarder. So like American Wasteland is probably playing my nostalgia for it is definitely playing, sure, into that. It's like wish fulfillment of like, what if I was like a cool skateboarder on the streets of LA and not a middle school teacher?
Well, this was back when you were like a teenager.
Yeah, not even a teenager, like a preteen. I was playing this game. So yeah,
that will probably inform a lot of what you're gonna say next time. Yeah. But the only other thing I've got to ask, I suppose, is what's the thing that you remember selling it? Like, I'm trying to get you to sell this to me, because so if I didn't enjoy it the first time.
Yeah, the one big level thing had a lot of novelty to it. I think that the story, as you, like, it is arcadey in a lot of ways, but I think that it kind of like backpedaled from Thug 2 because Thug 2 was just like so over the top jackass shit. Whereas this game, I'm not going to describe it as grounded, but I think that it does have a story that I have some affection for, of like, these are misfits that are your characters, and sure, there's a lot of over the top elements to them. I'm not going to describe them as lovable, but like the story of like, these are a group of skaters trying to like reclaim the city and like go back to the roots of like skate culture is something that I enjoy. And I think that the gameplay is just good as hell, that like Tony Hawk games feel great to play. I still love them and played so much of them that like, then if we look at a game like Tony Hawk Pro Skater 1 and 2 Remastered, which is, I believe, on our list of games to go through, this is, I think, a good way of looking at like the apex of the old Tony Hawk games, like where all of those gameplay elements kind of came together, so that then you can go into Pro Skater and kind of like appreciate how refined and excellent it is in that remaster. It's just like, it's so weird going back to old Tony Hawk games, because like, it wasn't until Tony Hawk 2 that they added the manual, and Tony Hawk 3 that they added the revert. I might be getting those revert. No, they would have to have the manual to have the revert. But like, these things that are like core to modern Tony Hawk gameplay didn't make it in until like surprisingly late in the series. So American Wasteland was the point where it's just like, this is every gameplay element for better or for worse. And just like play around with them in this kind of like sandbox environment. And it's nostalgia.
Yeah. I'm curious to see if it's nostalgia or quality. Cause as you said,
yeah,
this is the last good one you remember. Cause I do remember from this point on, there's a reason why these games are not being made a lot.
No. They went on to like Project 8, which I think actually people did actually kind of like Project 8, Proving Ground, the skate one where you had like the fucking plastic skateboard that you had to stand on. Things got bad after this. So yeah. I feel like it's a good representative. If I was going to tell anybody to go back and play the Tony Hawk games, I would tell them to play 1 and 2 Remastered, Thug and Thaw. And so I feel like you've already played Thug. Play a bit of Thaw and see how that treats you.
Cool. I'd be lying if I say I'm looking forward to it, but we'll see.
I'm also just curious about like nostalgia and how well things hold up or don't hold up. And and maybe reliving some of my past ambitions.
This is you going, I never got to talk about Thaw with anyone at the time. That's true. I have my moment.
I was just playing Tony Hawk alone in my house and like I never rode a skateboard. I was never like one of the skater kids in school. I wanted to be.
Looked over like with green with envy. Yeah.
Yeah. Now I just buy Vans and live vicariously through that.
Well, let's see.
Yes.